All right, everyone. Welcome back to Christian History and Ideas, episode 24. I'm John Coleman, and I am joined by and joining Dr. Nirmal Das. Welcome, Dr. Das.
Great to be here, John, as always.
So here we are in Holy Lent, and we're bringing our discussion from the plains of Tibet and the mountains of Tibet. I suppose they're better for mountains than for plains, from what I hear, and whatever the case may be, we're fast-forwarding in time and coming more local. We're looking at the situation of the church, particularly in the West, in the face of COVID-19, and in our discussions, we've kind of laid out the, frankly, abysmal state of the church visible at the moment. And now we turn our attention, before we get to the birth that is going to come ahead, without a doubt, in the church in the West and overall, we do have to address one point, and that is the community of people, maybe called the remnant, the pious, the conservatives, the traditional sorts. We'll play it easy with our adjectives here. Dr. Das gave us some very wise counsel on that point last episode, but we want to send that humble pie all over the place, and the old women with guitars and blue hair and Q-tips and Ash Wednesday, they've had their due, and we're gonna let up from them, and we're gonna turn our guns towards maybe those of us who feel a little bit more secure and that we got it figured out. Maybe we don't got it figured out so much. And Dr. Das, I wonder, what should we do for our kickoff verse here? I think we could pull from the breviary, or did you have any off the tip of your finger there?
Let's do the breviary now.
Okay.
That would be good.
So here we are. We have morning prayer from the Liturgia Errarum. And we speak of suffering, right? And we're not the first people to use the expression of the church suffering, or you know, likening the present chapter in church history to the crucifixion. So we're just building off of that observation, right? And this is, of course, Isaiah 53. It appears that lauds through his suffering, my servant shall justify many, and their guilt he shall bear. Therefore, I will give him his portion amongst the great, and he shall divide the spoils with the mighty. Because he surrendered himself to death and was counted amongst the wicked, he shall take away the sins of many and win pardon for their offenses. So that's again Isaiah 53. And in all of this messy surgery, as it is, we will remember that there's the great boon of Christianity, of, you know, redemptive suffering. So this will come to fruition. All right. So Dr. Das, we've talked a lot about modernity. A lot of our conversations go back to the 18th and 19th century. And here we are back in the 18th and 19th century. I think we can begin with a look at Vatican I, but were there some preceding considerations of that time period you'd like to bring up first?
Sure, yes. As we've looked at it previously in our discussions earlier, when we talk about the 19th century, it really is the foundation of what we, of our world today. A lot of the premises, a lot of the mindset, etc. The beginning of modernity, let's put it that way. But the point that I think that's really essential here is that in the 19th century, what was traditionally regarded as the church or the faith, you know, just to bring it back to what we were talking about, what was regarded as the church or the faith needed to be defined, redefined, or defined within the context of the new reality, which was the emergence of the nation state. because given how the nation states emerged in through the process of revolution, and I think this is the key here, and this is not simply the French Revolution or the American Revolution, but the one in Italy, the Risorgimento, the creation of the nation state. What is a nation? And within that is the entire process of what is a people, the definition. So what we really witnessed in the 19th century was the ultimate breakdown of Christendom. Previous to this, you had various understanding of what community was, what life within, you know, within geographical locations was, because it depended upon the structures that were there that had been created in conjunction with the church. The 19th century saw the breaking apart of that. And in that breaking apart, new realities coalesced. And these realities then needed to define what the church was all about. And I think what we need to talk about then is how in that within that reality of destruction, revolutionary destruction, and then recreation, you had the emergence of Vatican I and all of its you know, conditions and stipulations.
Right. Sorry about that. My mic was muted there. So here I'm back here, and now we'll get back to the screen share. Yes, excellent. Thank you, Dr. Doss, for that background. So here is Vatican I, or at least a representation of Vatican I. Looks to be maybe a charcoal drawing. I can't quite make it out, but very nice. Okay, keep in mind that the situation, always must take history into account. The situation of Vatican I is the siege of the Papal States. I believe they had been confiscated by this point by the new regime. Is that by 70? They had been confiscated, correct?
That is right. Yes. Yeah.
Okay. My first book looked at Vatican I, but I'm a little bit rusty on the dates. That was a few years ago. So, yes. So you have a vicious campaign. Charles Kalum has written very nicely on it. There have been a few others that have talked about this. It's very often overlooked that the oldest monarchy in Europe, the way that collapsed with Garibaldi and with the banking sorts and whatnot, and the real international brigade that came to support the Papal States, you know, we'll say 60 years before the left got into the game. You must keep in mind the rise of the secular nation state, and especially the reality that the Pope was under siege. Quite literally, they very, very likely could have come to shooting if Blessed Pius IX had not kept his head about him. If he had someone like John Coleman there, he'd turned it into Stalingrad or something. But lighter and better and more solid men prevailed. So that was seen there. But the Pope, basically, until Mussolini's time, is from, you know, 60 years is basically a prisoner in the Vatican with this new, if you'll excuse me, this new Freemasonic state that's now trotting around Italy. And in Vatican I, it's a response to that. Now, partially, I think very often overlooked with Vatican I is that 75% of the documents deal with, appropriate to the strains Dr. Doss is getting into, the damage that modernity has done to faith, right? I mean, 75% of the documents are hitting your basic, you know, Christianity 101 stuff. How do we know God exists? What is this about revelation in the Bible? Obviously, put this in the context of past discussions about the higher critical method and whatnot. But the one the aspect that concerns this episode and the aspect that actually sticks in the popular imagination about Vatican I is papal infallibility. And as part of that, before we get into that aspect, which I think is causing a great deal of the heartache and the headaches in the West, Vatican I is causing a lot of the problems right now, right? It's not Vatican II, it's Vatican I. Before we nuance that point, perhaps Dr. Doss and I, we can talk about the fact that the Vatican basically incorporates as a nation state, and that doesn't just affect its interaction with the larger world of legal fictions, but also, I argue, the mentality of Catholics themselves. You have the codification in 1917 of the Code of Canon Law. And after that, it's Katie bar the door. The religion increasingly becomes just filling out legal stipulations. And that's always, and this will be my last point, that's always the danger of legalism, is that you can get like candy and like other short-lived pleasures, you can get a kick, but there's no substance to it, which is modernity, I suppose. Legalism is great because it will produce, in short order, results. That's why the Romans use it and why people have been addicted to it since then. It organizes huge groups of men into acting in concert. But what it can never really provide against is internal disposition, and the form is there, and sometimes the form is very impressive, but the substance isn't there. And that, I argue, is the spirit that comes out of Vatican I. It's increasingly form over substance. It's increasingly impressive to look at. The Catholic Church actually gets more and more centralized, and it is, I just keep using that adjective, impressive, throughout much of the 20th century because of that, but it comes at a cost, because the form is grand, but the substance is increasingly ebbing away after Vatican I. And with that, I'll kick it over to Dr. Das.
Those are great points, John. And what I would like to add to that is this notion of... Well, you know, the Vatican itself becoming a state, as you mentioned, but more importantly, that the church needs to be run like a state, i.e. it becomes part and parcel of that new reality that is emerging on the geographical stage, i.e. the portioning off of earth into various forms of management, i.e. known as the nation state. And therefore, what becomes essential in the nation state is the importance and necessity of politics, of political parties, and all this. All these things emerge at this time very, very, you know, dramatically. And, you know, we won't get into all the revolutionary fervor that it engendered and all that sort of thing. But for our discussion, the church participates in this process as well. Instead of becoming a leader that says, well, no, sorry, this is not what this is all about. We're, you know, we're about all of this stuff, i.e. The body of Christ and what the purpose of faith is. Rather, the church, Vatican I, becomes engaged in this process of nation building, i.e. it constitutes itself as first and foremost as a nation, i.e. Where the Pope is like a president or a king or something like that, behaves like that, and all the legal obligations of that process. And, you know, on the micromanagement level, where they even have a, you know, a post office, they have, you know, a railroad line built in, et cetera, et cetera. Transportation becomes important. All these institutionalized necessities of a nation state become part and parcel. So you have, you know, embassies of the Vatican sent all over the world. You have people that are ambassadors and politicians engaged in this process. So, you know, why I'm listing all these things is to make, I think, a very essential point in all of this, is that I think it's here that the church accepts its role as subservient to the state. It's here that the church becomes what we in the COVID world now understand as non-essential service. It's what it is. And it is just part and must be treated like any other nation state. It loses its holy agency, I think, and it becomes part and parcel of the secular process that is the nation state. And this has been, I think, the essential tragedy, if we were to call it that, of Vatican I. And this has been the big struggle of the church as to how to define itself from here on in. Is it a kingship? Is it a state? Is it that? Is it this? And it spends most of its energy in that process. And we end up where we do.
Excellent, excellent. You know, there's a saying we have in history that, I suppose history is pretty good for sayings, they have all sorts of things, but the one that comes to mind is the plumber starts in the kitchen and he ends up in the street. That is to say, you have a leaky faucet. Okay, well, you have to fix the pipe underneath it, and then you have to fix the connector arm, and then you have to fix the spigot, and then, the main outside is broken, it needs to be fixed. Oh, no, you got to check out that sewer pipe, and so forth, and so forth. And you start with one problem, and you go back to, oh, there's another one. And I think this moment in time, transitional moment, whether it transitions as the powers that be want it or not, we'll see. But that as the remnant, as the church militant, as a chance to survey the field right now, looking back, I hope the discussion goes back farther than the 60s or Vatican II. I think that work has been done. It's been necessary work. And it goes back to Vatican I. And I think actually we will come to a point in this series where we will caution against Eastern Orthodoxy seeming like a solution. We won't get there today, but there is some benefit to listening to the critique of church history from an Eastern perspective to really understand there are certain trends that have manifested themselves both in Vatican I, in Vatican II, that are part, not of the deposit of faith, to use a 19th century term, but are very part and parcel of, shall we say, the eccentricities of the Western church. And that what we're seeing is not just the result of Vatican II, neither of Vatican I, but certain unhealthy, I argue, unhealthy lines of thinking that go back much farther. And as we all try to reappraise things, perhaps we can set aside some of the BS that we, bologna sandwiches, that we tell ourselves often. And one of those is, I'm sure all of us have had this experience with various aspects of history or with the academy or with some topic. We see a problem, we react to it, we might associate ourselves with a community that reacts with it. And then we realize the community, whilst their objections are correct, they themselves are making errors too. That happens often with the way the Civil War is taught in America. People realize the nonsense of the mainstream. Then they make the conclusion, okay, wow, the Confederacy had a lot of arguments. And then like 5 or 6 years after that, they get into, oh my goodness, the Confederacy was more tyrannical in its documents. And then and I've done that with education myself, and I could go on and on. But with the pious, shall we say, you find out, if you stay on the merry-go-round long enough, you find out that Vatican II is actually trying to fix some of the errors of Vatican I. And one of the things, when I got into the whole traditional Catholic thing when I was in high school, one of the things they talked about then, and this was before Suorum Pontificum, so it was like, it was like going to a speakeasy to find a Latin mass. I mean, this was, these things were like, they weren't looked kindly upon within, it was like, whatever, a magazine in a brown wrapper, that sort of thing. You didn't talk about the Latin mass and whatever. But one of the topics that community did talk about was called, was the subsistic clause in, was it Lumen Gentium or Gaudium et Spes, one of the documents that the Church of Christ subsists in the Catholic Church. And all of these so-called traditionalists would get their pride all up, and they would say, "What? This is a modernity, and this is modernism." And da 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 da. No, subsistent was trying to actually correct for the error that the legal corporation of the Vatican was the Church of Christ, which was something that was taught for a good stretch there, and that mindset of legalism is something that now that getting back to something we talked about last episode, and this will be my last point. If legalism works at all, it can either only work through some type of force. It doesn't have to be physical force. It could be threat or psychological force. Or if it works, and this is when it did work in the 19th century, is if you have a substrata of culture that at least can provide some sort of form. And what has completely collapsed since the 19th century, again, is the cultural pillars of Western society, within and without the church. Those are gone. And again, a lot of that's intentional. But so what are you left now with is a hollow church of legal formalism, where people don't know, there is no knowledge. And people are complaining about this lack, you know, people going through the motions, not knowing, going back half a century now. But that's what we're seeing right now. It's just keeping up. It's just keeping up. And there's a point I can make, but I've danced on the stage. Okay, the last part, just to conclude here with a cherry on top, and then I'll dance myself off the stage, is or near Mal will get the crook and pull me from Canada there. The last point is that the necessity of culture, and this is very vital to this understanding of legalism, which I always caution against. But regardless, if the culture is strong, there are strong families, strong economic autonomy, strong cultural ties in terms of, you know, your own folk music, you know why the streets are named what they are, you know about that family 10 generations going back, your next door neighbor, stuff we don't have. If that's strong, Christianity can muck through scenes of its history that are less edifying, right? That, I believe, explains why in the West the church was able to at least on a natural level, soldier on through very wicked papacies. And my goodness gracious, the entire 18th century is 100 years of mediocrity. H.G. Wells talks about this in the Outline of History. What did the 18th, I mean, it's just classified by, you thought the 1950s was just white bread mediocre. That was the whole 18th century on one level. And in terms of religiously speaking, and but why did it soldier on? And you had a certain rebirth in the 19th and 20th century. Why? Because you had the cultural soil was rich. Christian can always come back. And what we're faced now with is a very, very monolithic legal structure with a lot of bureaucrats keeping the buildings warm, keeping the lights on. But the cultural strata isn't there. And so the roots are not there. And that's my bit.
No, that's a very excellent analysis, I think. And to add to that, I would suggest is that it's that Daniel vision of this great entity with feet of clay. And you know, this is what this reminds me of is this idea. And I think this is the big struggle as well. That what the 19th century did, and what I think Vatican I as a reaction to all that was, and of course what ended up happening is that the church itself became this idea. there we go. the church itself became an idea as opposed to a physical entity. And this notion that church is an intellectual process. And this is, of course, the degradation of the Enlightenment within the context of faith. If you accept the Enlightenment, you are eventually going to be ending up putting the faith as a process of reason. And this has been the big tragedy and the problem with Protestantism, is that it can't break away from this notion of reason. So what happened then is that if you accepted the Vatican, if you accepted the church as a nation state, a version of nation of the nation state, you then obviously then always also accepted the notion that the faith is a process of reason. And this, by the way, is what the problem is with conservatism, the traditional Catholic, the traditional remnant crowd, etc., all those people who somehow think they've got it right. Unfortunately, they are also the products of the Enlightenment. which has accepted the view that faith of any kind is simply an intellectual choice. It's a process of reason. And if you can reason through things, you arrive at the truth. And notice how strong that equation is. That if you can reason things out, you end up with the truth. The church accepts it. The conservatives, traditionalists, etc., accept this, but it's wrong because this is not Christian, for lack of a better term, this is not Christian reasoning in any shape or form. So, because Christian reasoning has to include the process of faith and the necessity of God. So, what we're ending up with then in the 19th century, and I think the Vatican I documents are the end result of this idea, is that it is the fulfillment of the promise of the Enlightenment, which is the creation of the nation state. In the 18th century, it was done through the revolutionary process. The American and the French revolutions, did all that. In the Italian Revolution in the 1840s, the Risorgimento, that process became then completely intellectualized, where a nation state had to justify itself, justify its existence within the larger body. Notice what's going on here. And I think this is the interesting thing, and this is my reading of the Vatican I documents in that context. Notice what's happening here is that you are looking at the mystical structure of the church being secularized, i.e. you have this collection of nation states that operate according to a certain set of principles, legalities, which equal morality, which equal faith, which equal how one should live and what one should think. So what we're then really seeing in the 19th century is the erection or the creation of a secular church known as the nation states, i.e. now, and that's going to be perfected in what is now known as the United Nations. Notice the symbolism, notice the process here, i.e. the unity of faith. We must all come together as one. We must all work as one. This is this is the abandonment of Christian vocabulary by the church to the nation state, in which it becomes then part and parcel of that United Nations. So the Vatican is just like the US, Canada, France, Germany, whatever, and must therefore accordingly behave by those principles to which those nations govern themselves. And therefore the faith itself must be managed through that legality, through that structure, through that process. And I see Vatican I as the secular, the imposition of the secular church upon the world, i.e. it was the church had offered in the medieval era before all of this, the church had offered the world a very good way of managing reality and the faith and systems that created it. But in that process of nation building, what happens is that the nation itself becomes the faith entity, and therefore it replaces the church. And the church will always, from the 19th century onwards, will always be secondary. It will always be, to use COVID terms, non-essential. And that's the real problem that we are then now dealing with here in our day and age. So all the reactionaries, the conservatives and the traditionalists and all this sort of thing, somehow misunderstand themselves, their purpose, and misunderstand where we're headed with all of this stuff, i.e. the solution is not to go back to Vatican I or something like that. The solutions, and this is the other problem, by the way, the nation state's agency of salvation what its purpose is to guarantee some sort of salvation. And what is its salvation or redemption? It's to offer solutions to problems, i.e. collective solutions to problems faced. That is redemption in the secular sense. And of course, all these other people engage, like the remnant crowd, the conservatives and traditionalists, engage in that process of building solutions, of managing the crisis, what we talked about earlier. And that is the real problem here. So, you know, I agree with you completely that we are dealing with a creature here that was created in the 19th century, which we can no longer properly handle because we've become the creature. You know, we are the creature now, and yet we're trying to critique it. Good luck, you know.
Excellent, excellent. So just to, if I may put a pencil point on what you're saying, and let me know if you agree with it. Both the, forgive me, the normie church, the Novus Ordo, the lame suburban church around the corner, with its Novus Ordo Missal and Breviary of St. Paul VI, right? But that crew, as well as all your conservatives and all your traditionalists who think that they're holding this traditional Christianity, we are all of us slaves of the 19th century, and we are all of us trying to recreate a church which was created at Vatican I, which no, well, do you agree with that point?
Yes. Okay. I agree.
And if I may turn our discussion towards a critique of the pious, based off of that, one of the things I noticed, now remember, our future episodes here are going to be looking at historical developments and where things are going. And so I think a lot of these are going to shake out one way or another. So we're not going to use that 19, oh, it's disproved. Catholicism is disproved. The traditional thing's been debunked. No, we're not talking. That's how children talk. Modern children. No, a lot of these are problems. They have to be addressed. But these are not forever and a day impassable problems. As the dynamics exist now, they are impossible, but history and God have a way of shaking these out. So we'll talk about that shakeout in future shows. But regarding the pious or the traditional or whatever, the church militant, and even that term, you talk about modernity. When I say church militant, I'm thinking about a certain media corporation right now when I say that term. You see? So everything has become legalized and Popeyes and so forth. But amongst the devout, what I have noticed is, and I've been watching this community now for, you know, 15 years, a bit more than 15 years. I was kind of a weird high schooler. So other people were getting into other things. I was getting into, this line of thinking. So, but I've been around for a bit in this world, and I've watching, and I've been very involved in certain aspects in terms of my working career as well. So I've noticed certain things, and I've clearly noticed that, well, as they say in the homeschool community, the homeschoolers today are not the homeschoolers from the 1980s, and that's not a compliment. And likewise, the traditional Catholics today are not the traditional Catholics of the 70s and 80s. And I've interviewed a lot of those people, and I've written about them, so I should know. But even in the time that I've been observing things more near to my experience on this earth, I've noticed there's been clearly a drift in that community, at least in this neck of the woods in North America, in the English language, where, frankly, a lot of the traditional Catholics are sounding and thinking like evangelical Protestants. They are sounding and thinking like that community. There are many beautiful things about evangelical Protestant people, but there are many errors. If Dr. Doss will allow me to make such points, you know, I don't say this in a cantankerous tone of voice, yeah. But here's a few things just from my own experience with people, not to kill us with anecdotes. Okay. I hear this often when I bring up this point about Vatican II, Vatican I, you're overthinking things. Okay. Again, that was the whole, anyone who's at all conversant with traditional Christian apologetics knows the sublimation of reason over passions or sentiments, right? And frankly, one of the talking points of Catholicism since the Reformation has been, look, it's clear, it's black and white. You always know what it believes. Because it's so black and white, that's why the Society of St. Pius X had to put this out. This is almost a parody. Clear ideas on the Pope's infallible magisterium. And then they give you about 20 pages of text with quotes. And by the time you're done with it, it's anything but clear. Leaving aside the validity of that, that was always one of the traditional, the historical Catholic talking points, is things are clear and you know what it believes. This is rash and God gave you a reason. Let us talk these things out like men, like in the book of Proverbs. And now I talk to this community and I bring these points up and they start shucking and jiving. It's uncomfortable to learn that the whole conservative thing is just as modernist as those liberals you were damning for the last 30 years. So they say, oh, you're overthinking things, John. Then I get straight out of American backwoods Protestantism, all that matters. Hey, John, whatever. I don't care. Put aside them that Denzinger. I don't care. All that matters is my relationship with Jesus. I mean, I'm actually here. Now, that is, in ontologically, that is correct. Again, that's not the whole story, which is, I guess, Protestantism. You got a correct principle, but you don't expand on it. Okay, we had a church, one of the traditional Catholic communities here, split, right? Just like a Protestant church, right? I mean, in the old, you know, your old backwoods, you know, Brother Billy disagrees with Brother Timmy, and he goes off and, right? We had that. I don't want to get too much into it because I know people around here. I don't want to step on toes unduly. I don't want to cause division, but that happened and people know what I'm talking about. And what did they put in when they went to the town corporation to get their permission from their Freemason town council to have their church? And to get the realtor, what did they say in the paper? What did they say? These are traditional Catholics. They said, we're not looking. They were trying to kiss up to the neighbors. And we're not looking to grow. We're not looking to grow. This was in the paper, the Danbury News Times. This community, their leader said that. We're not, what Christian says that? Wow. Right? But this is the thinking. Okay? The last one. Right? I pointed this Vatican I thing out to these pious people. I'm not talking about one or two people. I'm talking, you know, there's a composite of dozens and dozens of people in over a dozen years. Right? I pointed this out. And what did I said, look, what the traditionalists so-called are doing, or the conservatives, is not traditional. It's not conservative. And it's a break with the historical way that things have developed in the West, just going off and creating your own community, which is completely understandable given the chaos. I'm not giving guys with families a hard time doing that, but just we're making an intellectual point. What did one of these hardcore sorts tell me? I'm not interested in historical Christian continuity. I mean, what is this? You get what I'm saying. I don't need to elaborate anymore, but this is the thinking that has arisen. Now it's in response to the crises, but it's unacceptable.
Exactly. I think great points and great examples, by the way. I think examples bring all this home very, very clearly. You know, just to cap off what you're saying and, you know, suggest a way out of this process, what I would like to suggest is that what we need to do is to, and this is going to happen over time, this is not going to be happening, you know, overnight. We have to come up with ways of rejecting, not replacing, but right now rejecting modernity in various ways. And the first and foremost is this allegiance to terminology that we have, that we've developed. And this is the sad part of faith. You know, perhaps it's part of the Protestant mega culture that dominates everything. But this idea that you have to belong to, you have to adhere to certain kinds of talking points, for lack of a better term, to use, you know, a term that everyone mentions all the time. So what we need to do is to stop ourselves being allied with certain kinds of political entities, for lack of a better term, and mixing them up with our faith. and saying, you know, I got to do this and this. This was brought home, you know, wonderfully and very cogently in the, you know, last 4 years of the, you know, of the political debate, i.e., there was this great confusion of Christianity with the process of politics. And that was a perfect expression of what this is all about. I think what we really have to first and foremost do is to clarify what exactly is it that we're all about. You know, this is going to be, is it going to be supporting X party, you know, and then you're a Christian because all X Christians support party X or, you know, candidate X. I won't name any names. But, you know, this is the process that we're all engaged in. And unfortunately, for the majority of the quote unquote, exactly, the laying on of hands, etc. But the problem, this is the problem. This is the real problem of where Christianity is at. And by the way, this is Protestant and Catholic. This is not one person, and this is everybody. Let me just put it, let me be blunt. This is the Western baptized person. Let's put it that way. It'll make things easier for us. This is where they're at, that salvation is looked upon through the political process, that man X, you know, President X is going to do X. He's going to deliver the utopia that we've always wanted. And all we got to do is somehow manage that process and then end up with that utopia. And of course, the recent disappointment of 2020, of course, tells us how, how terrible that is. Exactly. So symbolism like that is what where we're at, unfortunately, with this process. Once we get beyond these things, and this is the big struggle right now, we must somehow learn to divorce this notion of Christianity, or let me just put it this way, this notion of what being baptized is all about, with the reality of our faith. And if we don't know, if we don't know how to, you know, manage that disconnection, we will always end up with that confusion, where we are confused with our politics and our faith and our this and our that, and we live the world and we encounter the world in that confusion. And this has been the tragedy, I think, of the modern world in the last 4 years, especially. But you know, it's brought, everything's been brought to a head in that regard. This has been the tragedy of the world in that any notion of faith has been destroyed completely. So when we're talking about modernity and its ruptures, one of the most tragic ruptures has been of the faith system itself, Christianity itself, where Christianity has been so ruptured, and I just don't mean Protestants and all that sort of thing, has been so ruptured that people don't know what to do with it. They don't know how to manage it. So they end up looking for political solutions, that somehow this man is going to be the savior. And it's interesting. I found that really actually interesting and disturbing how, you know, your last president was given all kinds of messianic terms, you know. He became the messenger, the chosen one, and all that sort of thing. And this was fine and dandy with everybody. And this is, you know, this kind of thing tells you where the faith is in the modern West. This is not just America, it's everywhere. So what we have to then learn to do is, first and foremost, is to understand, not simply understand the problem, but understand or come up with ways of proceeding with a rupture from modernity. Just as modernity ruptures us, we have to rupture ourselves from modernity. Exactly. Right. Well, what can I say? Exactly. Right. That's quite the coin, by the way. So that's what I mean. This is what we have to look, stop looking for secular saviors and messiahs. This is the problem.
For people who aren't familiar, that's a coin that was minted, I believe, in the nation state of Israel with Cyrus, or I might have actually think it was sold by evangelicals here on behalf of Zionist Israel, with Cyrus, the great Old Testament pagan savior and of the Hebrews, and Donald Trump. And I'll bring that up again as Dr. Das continues.
It's a great image, but that's where we're at. That's my point. Exactly. Yeah. So Cyrus, Belfour, and Trump. that's quite the trinity. Notice it's a trinity. I mean, that was my next point I was going to bring up. But thank you. Yes, I'm glad you brought that up. But one of the processes of the modern secular version of Christianity is the imposition of false trinities that replaces the real one. We began with the revolution, the French Revolution. Notice its great trinity was equality, liberty, fraternity. And of course, this is also part and parcel of the American Revolution. It's the same sort of trinity that was established. So modernity has always been the replacement of the Holy Trinity with secular trinities. And the trinities, for example, that we have today are so many. There's so many of them that are versions of this equality, liberty, fraternity. There's gender, race, environment, environmentalism. The trinity of death. You have abortion, euthanasia, assisted suicide, etc., etc. And these are all, but notice, these are all secular moralities. This is a good thing. All these are good things to be pursued. And nation states collectively pursue them, including the Vatican. They pursue these things in various shapes and forms. They pursue secular trinities. In my mind, this is the biggest problem with the conservatives, traditionalists, whatever, is that they accept the secular trinities and pursue them. And notice one of the methods of pursuit is also rejection, by the way, because if you reject a trinity, you are simply saying that it exists and it has influence over you. What you need to do, the proper way of understanding or dealing with this sort of approach is to relegate it to what it really is, which is satanic energies, the devil, and so forth. Because it's the job of the devil to always do the Antichrist version of Christ. That's what this is all about. Since we've degraded our faith, we no longer understand what this is all about. And to stop me going on and on about this very quickly, what I would like to suggest is that we no longer understand how to deal with evil. We've confused evil with political processes. And therefore, we don't know what we're doing. So when we react to secular trinities in our own way, we are reacting to them and therefore strengthening them, because we then give justification to why those trinities should exist. So by reaction, to trinities of, gender, race, environment, all that sort of thing, we are giving them justification. But what we need to do is to understand them as a process of evil, and then we have an entire system of how to combat that evil. But if we just simply react to, now look what they did, and then we make videos and get all excited about it and all that sort of thing and write articles and books,
we could make a very lucrative, we could have many, many subscribers and make a very lucrative YouTube world just doing that if we wanted
to. Exactly. I was just going to get to that. That is the other process of capitalization of ideas. So we, if we are truly faithful, we must understand what the faith is and how it engages us with the entirety of reality, not simply an intellectual process. because the minute we get into that mode, well, then good luck. We've lost, they've won, because we can't outthink the devil in that regard on our own, you know? And I guess this is what I really should stress, and we haven't stressed this enough, is the agency of the devil or Satan, the satanic, you know, agency in the world.
Perhaps we should save that appropriate topic for our next episode. Maybe we'll begin on a grave note, but an important note in this discussion as we take things, Dr. Das, very appropriate to that that closing point here, and that we will begin with that point, but also where the nation state structure is going, what I believe is a new order that will replace it, and we can talk briefly about the dynamics of that as regards the church, because I think a lot of these problems, and there are absolute contradictions right now, but those will be sorted out by history. Contradictions in your institutional, visible, Novus Ordo Church, whatever, and amongst your pious people. Both of them are slaves of the 19th century, and I think an order is arising that will make that entire paradigm irrelevant.
Well, I'm hoping for a new medievalism. That's my, that's where we have to get into eventually, because that's going to defeat all this sort of thing.
Indeed.
Not a going back to it, by the way.
Yes.
But reinventing a refurbishment would be a better term.
Excellent. And we can pray for freedom from the clock, which we don't have at this hour. So we are out of time for our second episode here of episode 24 of Christian History and Ideas. Dr. Das, tell us a little bit about the Postol and any good articles that we might look at this month.
Sure. In the next month coming in March, we have some very interesting ones. We're going to be continuing our critique of Marxism, evolution, and not in the traditional sense of, it's wrong and all that sort of thing, but in a very rational way, i.e. as a process of logic, i.e. that Marxism, evolution, etc. are failed processes of rationalism, i.e. they don't make rational sense, if we're using rationalism as the way the world works. So it's a very interesting article, very lengthy one, but a very interesting one from one of the foremost philosophers of our day. It's going to be very, very, I think, devastating for these people that promote these kinds of ideas. But what it also does is that it brings faith back to its original form, which is really important. And that is a faith that exists beyond rationality. And I don't mean feeling and all that sort of thing, as people always assume. So that's a great article that's coming out.
Excellent. And as regards Apostasis and Institute for the Humanities, the school Dr. Das and I run, if any of you have an interest in studying the humanities systematically, thoroughly, rigorously, but without, we'll say, a lot of the bologna sandwiches of modern academe, then please consider the school. And you may do that, first off, by going to apostasisinstitute.wordpress.com. All of the classes you will see listed there as of a few months in either direction of this recording will be run in the summer 2021 session, as well as in the autumn, and we have some other goodies coming down the pike. So keep an eye on that fine website. And then last of all, if you have any commentary or questions or observations, or indeed volunteer suggestions, maybe you have some knowledgeable area you yourself would like to talk about, kind viewer, please write us at christianhistoryandideas@gmail.com, and we look forward to getting those words from you. Dr. Das, thank you for your time and your insight into this very pressing topic. I'm afraid it will be with us for a while ahead, so we have some additional commentary, and we're going to pick up with that final point. And viewers, thank you for your insights, and it's been a pleasure.
Please, always a pleasure.